Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money because whether or not we like it, money matters. I'm your host, Maisha French. It's September, which means the spring and sun is here and it's arrived. But more importantly, it's also National Wills Week. And this is the time of year that we focus on making sure our paperwork is in order. Now, as uncomfortable as this makes us feel, there is one thing we can be certain about, and that is that one day we will no longer be alive. Yet despite the fact that death is part of life, only 30% of people have a valid will. And I must say, I see in my own life, my own journalism, so many cases where families are thrown into complete and utter chaos because there's no will or the will has been badly drawn up. You know, and let's be honest, when there's money on the table, all sorts of people come out of the woodwork. And quite frankly, a lot of these issues can be resolved by having a proper will drawn up. So today I'm speaking to Denisha Nadesan, who's Executive Director of Estates at Capital Legacy, about the mistakes to avoid when drawing up your will. So welcome, Denisha, and I'm sure you have your stories to tell after all the experiences you have.
Maya, thanks for inviting me to speak on your show. You've actually hit the nail on the head. My opening line to anyone, what's worse than having no will is having a will that's not properly drafted. Yeah, we could write books on the amount of estates that we've administered where there's just a number of issues that comes up because there hasn't been proper estate planning done in those estates.
I want to start off, I want to have a look at the ones that are the most common mistakes that you come across. And I know certainly in my line of work, not understanding your marriage contract and how that affects your will, that seems to be a really big issue.
Yeah, so marriage contract is one of the things, but there's other things. So let's talk a little bit about the consequences of a marriage contract. What we are actually speaking about is sequence of events. And that's one of the things you have to consider before drafting your will. There's certain things that happens in your life that occurs before death, like a divorce. You can't get divorced after death. You can only get divorced before death. If there is a settlement agreement and it hasn't been honored during your lifetime, it is now the executor's responsibility to honor what's in the settlement agreement before any assets can be administered on a specific deceased estate. If we talk a little bit more about marriages, let's talk a little bit about in community or property. Right? Everything's lovely when we get married. We love the person. Nothing can go wrong. We get married in community or property. That means we're sharing all of the assets and we're sharing all of the debts as well. So when a will is drawn up, you can only give away or bequeath assets that belong to you. If you're married in community or property, guess what? Your spouse owns half the assets. You can't give away something that you do not own yourself. If we go one step further and we talk about things like an accrual marriage, where you've included an accrual calc in your marriage, that will have to be determined first. And it could either be a claim against the estate, where your estate needs to pay a surviving spouse a certain amount of money, or it could be against your spouse paying into the deceased estate. And all of those things that I speak about is the consequences or the sequences that we have to follow while administering an estate.
I mean, those are really, really important points. I've seen a lot of wills where they'll say, well, I leave X percent to my children and then to my spouse without realizing that their spouse already has 50%. So they think, oh, I'm going to leave 50% to my spouse and then 25, 25 to my children. But without realizing that that actually is, you know, basically the spouse now is getting an additional 50% of the estate because they're getting 50% of the deceased spouse's estate over and above what they would have already received. So I think I see a lot of those sort of issues. But the other one that I also come across quite often is where the will is not witnessed properly. And I think it's really important to know who can actually witness a will.
Yeah. So that's really important. And that's one of the things where everybody knows, okay, we need to do a will, but not many people know what's the formalities to validly execute a will. And in terms of the Will Act, it's a little bit archaic, whereby it forces you to have ink on paper, pen on paper. So it has to be in a written format. It has to be physically signed by a testator, and it has to be witnessed by two competent witnesses present at the same time and in presence of each other. So it's not like I can go to witness one and sign in that room, and then tomorrow I'll go to another witness because I didn't have two witnesses available at the same time. Makes it a little bit difficult for people. I do understand that, but that is what the law requires.
Mm.
In addition to that, anyone over the age of 16 years is allowed to execute a will.
And what about in terms of, are there people who cannot witness a will and that are excluded from witnessing a will, other than age being an issue?
Yeah. So there's certain classes of person that are excluded as witnesses in a will. Anyone who stands to benefit from the will or their spouses may not witness, or they're not a competent witness in terms of the law. Obviously, all the natural exclusions in terms of mental capacity, age of majority, those kind of things obviously applies. But if you are a nominated beneficiary in the will, you may not sign as a witness, nor can your spouse sign as a witness.
That was actually something I wasn't aware of. So in other words, if I was a beneficiary of a will and my husband could not then be a witness, which I think quite interesting. I wonder how many people don't realize that. I think that's quite a big one. And the other one also, I think this is perhaps an issue when we have property. So most people, their two biggest assets are their pension fund and their property. And there's probably not much else really available. I want to get to your pension because that's not part of your will. And I want to explain that. But how do you, what should you look out for when leaving a property? So either you may be in a situation where you have a property and you want to leave it to several children, for example, or maybe your child is still a minor. What should you be considering then?
I think before we even get there, whether it's property or any other assets, it's important to remember in South Africa, we've got something called freedom of testation, where a testator can decide what assets to give to, who to give it to, and what sort of percentages or how to distribute the estate. It's very different to other laws whereby there's, or other countries where there's forced heirship, whereby your next of kin automatically inherit from your estate. Here, a testator can choose who he wants to give his property to. Giving properties to minors, although it's possible in terms of the law, a minor can hold property in their name, it is just not practical to do that, because the minor is limited in terms of the rights he will have on the property. He can't encumber the property, take a bond on it, he can't sell it without first approaching the master's office and getting consent for things like that. I mean, there's ways to work around it, and the type of things that we recommend is if there's a benefit going to a minor, make sure it's housed in a testamentary trust for a determined time, and then you are then free to deal with the assets accordingly.
So, I mean, that's obviously the minor child. They can, you need to obviously to make sure that there's somebody managing the property for them, that there's liquidity to keep the property going. There's taxes, rates, levies, all of those things. I think people often don't think about those costs. And also, do you see issues sometimes, similar type of issues, where a parent has now divided the property maybe among three kids? And then there's this issue between who, some want to sell, some want to keep, who's going to pay the rates, the levies, the maintenance costs?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's one thing leaving a property in a testamentary trust, but if there's no liquidity following that property, there's not too much a trustee can do on that property. They can't maintain it. They can't maintain the rates, taxes, because all we've got is a physical asset. Mm. In deceased estates, we've got two types of costs. We've got admin costs, that is your executive fees, your transfer costs to put the property to the names of the beneficiaries, those type of things. But there's also other sort of liabilities that becomes due and payable on the date of your death, like your home loan. Your home loan becomes due and payable the day that you pass away. And the banks will call the executor to settle the full home loan that's due on the date of death.
Again, okay, so that's quite interesting. So it's not like the estate can continue to fund the mortgage. Basically, on that day, if you do not have life cover to pay it off, you have to sell the property.
Yeah, so not many people read that in their bond T's and C's before they sign it up. We're excited. We're owning our first property. I know I can pay it on a monthly basis. No one's actually looking at the T's and C's. And the T's and C's calls in for the full capital on the date of death. The bank is a little bit lenient with us. They'll probably let us carry on for about 3 months of paying the monthly bond costs if we still need to realize money coming from life cover or getting money from bank accounts, those sort of things. But the funds are requested by the third month by the bank in terms of settlement. And I mean, if there's a disconnect between where the liquidity pays, where my life cover pays, and my executor that needs to settle the bond, then your heirs and executors have to have some difficult decisions on their hands. And they might have to, you know, you've got some cherished assets there. You've got a property that you guys all grew up in for 30 years. Your parents had this house. But if life cover is paying somewhere else and there's a bond that still needs to be settled, someone needs to make a difficult decision there. Mm.
In fact, it's quite interesting you say that, because when my mom was doing her will, she wanted to leave the property to, there's four of us, because she thought we would use it as a holiday property. And we were like, we all live in different parts of the world and country. And we were, well, who's going to pay for this? Who's going to use it? And we said to him, no, we just want you to put in the will that it will be sold and the proceeds paid out, because we didn't want to be in that situation where now one person wants to keep it and the others don't, and it starts becoming an issue. And I also know there's only, you know, who's going to actually keep maintenance, who's going to run it. And I was concerned that the kids closest to the property were the ones who were going to be landing up carrying the full cost. So I think you really do need to not be too sentimental about these things and saying, oh, it's the family home and all this. If there's a child who really wants the family home, and you give an order to sell it, that child can always buy it. They can bond it, they can take out a bond on it, and they can buy it from the other siblings. I do think this is something that we need to break a little bit of the sentimentality around it. I just see this as such an issue generally.
Yeah. Maya, I think it's easier said than done. I mean, the family dynamics and family relationships don't always allow us to have those open conversations. What I've seen in my experience is the first time somebody realizes what's in their parents' will or in their spouse's will is when we go to meet with the family and get ready to report the estate to the master's office. You know, it's something that has been avoided in families for a very long time. And some surprises that are in the will, some invited and some not.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of, I was speaking to somebody also who's involved in the will industry, and she was saying that you would have a meeting with the family, you'd discuss the will, and then you'd walk out the door, and next things you'd get a phone call from one of the spouses saying, there's a child from another family that I haven't mentioned to anyone. So yes, often that's exactly what happens. Some of the truth comes out. But I wanted to, maybe if you haven't had a conversation with your family, you could still indicate in your will why you made a specific decision. Because I think there are people who go and contest a will thinking that the will was badly written, or that wasn't the intention of the person. And I'm going to give you an example. I've used my mother already. I'm going to use her again. So there's four of us, four kids. Two are from my mom's first marriage and two are from a second marriage. So I'm from the second marriage, and my father passed away, and his funds were invested in a portfolio for my mom, which she uses. But in her will, she has stipulated that my brother and I are the sole beneficiaries of that, not my sisters, because that was not their father's legacy. But she has explained that in the will, because otherwise you could come along and you think, oh, mom doesn't love us. She gave more money to the other siblings and not me. It feels unfair. Whereas just a simple sentence explaining the decision. Do you see that quite often, or do you think we should put a little bit more information in the will?
To me, a will needs to be as simple as possible. The more you add to it, leaves more room for interpretation. The problem with interpretation is that, number one, a master's office cannot interpret a will. If there is anything that cannot be easily understood, they will request the executor to approach the high court for a declaratory order with regards to things like interpretation of certain clauses in a will. And that's one of the things you should avoid. Also, there's certain things that needs to be in a will, and there's certain things that needs to live outside a will, like your last wishes. I want my dog to be kept by my sister on the beach because she lives in Cape Town. I know my dog's going to be comfortable there. That information doesn't live on a will. Your will should only deal with your pure assets. Anything that is not related to your asset should live in something like a last wishes document or in a digital electronic format that can be accessed by your families.
That's interesting, this concept of your last wishes. How does that work, and how legally, you know, viable is it?
So last wishes is not a legal binding document, but it is an instruction to your family that would have been your wishes. If you think about something like your burial wishes and cremation wishes, by the time the executor receives that will from safe custody, the funeral and the wake and all of those things would have happened. We meet with the family a week after that. By that time, all of that stuff has happened. There's no place in the will to deal with a burial wish, cremation wish, I need my horses in the stable to go to that specific vet. If it's not specific assets, it should not be in a will. It complicates wills unnecessarily.
Okay, but important. You can attach a letter of wishes that at least gives some guidance. And you can also, in those letter of wishes, perhaps even explain some of your choices and why you did them, so that they're not considered a mistake or, you know, coercion, perhaps. I think that coercion often comes in. People feel their parents were coerced into something, they were sweet talked into it. I think if you can give explanation some way that can take away some of that ill will and, you know, the infighting that happens on death. And you know, you spoke about the master's office. Is there ever a time that the master's office can actually overrule a will, can say, well, you know, this will's not fair, or they haven't taken something into consideration?
So the master does not have that ability. The master's office is a creature of statute. So in terms of a specific law, the master's office was created. The master's office is there to be the guardians or upper guardians of all minors, protect creditors, and protect heirs or anybody else that has an interest in the estate. They cannot administer wills. They can only make a determination on the will based on the Wills Act. So if it's signed in wet ink, it's got the two witnesses above 16 years old, good to go. The master he cannot interpret a will, and he cannot decide whether something is fair or unfair in a will because of freedom of testation. If there is dispute with regards to the will, maybe a disagreement between the executor and the family, then we would have to go to the High Court to get a declaratory order with regards to intention of the testator.
But what about circumstances where perhaps there's a maintenance claim, for example? They may have minor children, but they have excluded those children from that, or minor children from another relationship, but there is actually a maintenance claim against them. Is that claim then put against the estate? How do those sorts of issues work?
That's exactly what it is. It's a claim against the estate. What happens is that the person that's claiming, whether it's a surviving spouse that doesn't benefit from the will, for example, if we go back to the marital regime, I was married without accrual, which means I've got no claim against the estate. I want to put in a maintenance of surviving spouse claim. I can put that claim through. It'll go to the executor to determine whether this claim is valid or invalid. That is included as a liability in the estate, which has to be settled before any distribution of the estate happens. Irrespective of whether there's a will or no will, a maintenance claim or a child's maintenance claim will be a liability in the estate, which must be settled before any bequests.
You see, this is why it's so important to have a properly written will, because if you've considered all those things, so you have freedom of testate, but you there are still obligations that even your estate has to carry out in your death. And if you understand those, then you can make sure that your will is constructed in such a way that it allows for those obligations. So again, you know, I think it's so important to get advice when writing up a will. I'm really not a big fan of free wills, those sort of DIY wills, because for this exact reason, there are so many things we don't really know about the law that can have a huge impact, especially when you have family and spouses and all of those things. And the other one that I think people often make a mistake with is thinking that their pension forms part of their will, and that I have seen people as putting in their wills that I leave my pension to XYZ, but your pension is totally and utterly separate from your will.
100% correct. So if the deceased was a mentioned, if the deceased was a member of a pensions fund, the Pensions Fund Act determines who gets to benefit from that particular pension. And when we talk about pensions, we're talking about pensions, preservation funds, provident funds, retirement annuities. Okay. In terms of the act, it'll look at things like, or the trustees of the pension fund will look at things like who were your legal and financial dependents and who have you nominated as beneficiaries in that particular pension fund and make a determination. Does it limit freedom of testation? Yes, it does completely, because it is the trustees that make that final determination. Again, what's important to remember is that those assets are not included in your estate. The families generally deal with the pension fund separately to what the executor is dealing with. The only time that they do actually come together is obviously the pension fund needs to be taxed and the executor needs to finalize the taxes on the estate. One thing needs to be done before the other.
And we spoke a little bit earlier about property and the costs of keeping a property going. But I have to tell you, I was shocked at the cost of what my estate would cost to wind up, both from, you've got things like, you've got death duties, you've got executive fees, you may even have capital gains tax because all of your assets are considered as deemed sale at the time of your death. So how does one, how important is it to calculate all of those costs upfront and make sure that you have liquidity either as life cover or as investments to cover that?
100%. These things are really overlooked. When financial planning is done, very few people actually consider what would be your executable value of your estate. How much would you have to pay the attorneys to transfer the property from yourself to your surviving spouse? What sort of values of estates do you have? What percentage needs to apply for estate duty? Rightfully so, it's a deemed disposal on death. And the thing is, people have life cover, but they think about the immediate things like, I have enough life cover to settle the bond. Settling the bond just gets you one step, but there's also a whole lot of administration processes that needs to be followed. If we look at things like estate duty, everybody knows this as death taxes, but also we need to make sure that estate duty is calculated correctly. There's certain exclusions and certain assets that are not allowed, like your pension funds are not subject to estate duty. And things like your funeral costs is a estate duty deduction. If you give any benefit to your surviving spouse, those are deductions. There's lots of things and clever tools that you can use within the act to try and limit your liability in your estate. However, the bottom line is, again, we sit with families and they need to make a decision on liquidity of the estate because there isn't sufficient liquidity provided during the lifetime when the person passes away, and we sit with a huge tax bill and we sit in front of the families and like, okay, what assets are we going to sell?
And SARS is always the first creditor. It's not like you can say, well, do SARS, do you mind waiting? SARS wants their money pretty quickly. And the other people who want their money pretty quickly are the executors, because they need the money to go and obviously wind up the estate. So that is also something. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of getting an executor, I know you can obviously appoint a family member who then in turn can appoint, an executor or a fiduciary expert on your death. Or you can engage immediately with an executor. And I think in that case, one of the benefits, of course, is your ability to negotiate fees, because there's a maximum fee, but you don't necessarily have to pay that. So, is it important to discuss, to decide who your executor is and make a lot of those decisions upfront?
So the thing about executor fee is that it's regulated. The Act determines what's the maximum allowable fee that an executor might charge. At this stage, it's 3.5% of the gross value of your estate. And obviously that is added onto that. A second charge that can come in, which is very common with executors in the industry, is a 6% collection commission on any income that has been earned from the date of death to when the executor has been administering the estate. Fees are negotiable. Executors do look at things like complexity of the estate, what's fair and reasonable in that certain circumstance. But at the same time, I want to implore that the administration work is not easy. It's not quick. I think people have underestimated the role of the executor and the fiduciary duties that they need to uphold in this whole process.
You know, I must say, I was actually speaking to a financial planner who their firm does. They have lawyers who help with winding up the executor estates. And she was saying the cost of it is actually very significant, what it costs them to pay the lawyers to do it. So I think there is she said it is a huge amount of work, actually, to wind up an estate. And I think one of the challenges we've certainly seen in the last, or since COVID, has been the master's office itself and the delays there. And we've seen, I've been writing a lot of articles about this, so I know. And then there's been delays with the banks often in you know, creating the estate late accounts and giving the correct account details and the correct balances to executors. So it is an expensive process. And I think you do need to be aware of this when you are writing up your will and making sure that these costs are at least covered. But I think this is, I suppose my question here really to end off with is, how important is it to pay for good advice when writing up your will? Because I do see all these free wills that banks give, and I'm always nervous when I see this sort of mess that I come across so often. You know, is it really worth, I don't know. I think it's worth paying an expert to sit down and say, listen, let's look at your entire estate. What do you want? You know, how are you married? How many children do you have? You know, all of those things. It is really, really important.
No, 100%. And I think it's only once you have administered an estate do you realize the true do's and don'ts and what the unintended consequences of having certain clauses in your will, certain terms like the difference between a partner and a spouse. That has a massive difference in our law and how we interpret things like that. In my experience, I've seen things like template wills coming out. You know, we get them from a bookstore and we nearly complete it and consider that to be a valid will. Apart from a valid will is the safe custody of the will. Lots of wills, if it's gone into the wrong hands, those things get destroyed, you know, and it's futures that get destroyed. Having a professional sit down with you, consult with you, I cannot stress how important this is. Sometimes we need to hear the good, the bad, the ugly. This is probably one of the most important documents you will ever sign in your lifetime.
And I suppose one of the things is it is Wills Week. We are trying to encourage people to go out and sign a will. It's probably a good starting point, even if it is the DIY one from the template, at least have something, I suppose, in place. But then once you've got that in place, go then and actually book and make an appointment with a fiduciary expert to just make sure that you have a proper, you know, will put in place that it does what it needs to do for you. And I think that you've also brought in things like liquidity and making sure that there is enough funds to make sure that estate can be wound up and that your beneficiaries receive the money that I think you're hoping that you're going to leave them. So that would definitely be my take out as well. And any last kind of words of warning or wisdom that you'd like to leave the listeners?
I think just to go back to what you actually started with, having a poorly drafted will is worse than having no will.
Absolutely. And I see that all the time. So absolutely. Thank you. And thank you, Denise. I think that's given a lot of food for thought. I certainly have thought of a few things when speaking to you. And I said, as I said, the witnessing, that was a new thing to me, that your spouse, the spouse of the beneficiary cannot be a witness either. That can make it invalid. So again, get good advice. And please, listeners, you know, this is the reality. You're not going to be here forever. You have assets. You have spent time and effort and worked hard to build the assets you have. Make sure that they're distributed, you know, the way you want to by having a will. So thank you.